Hello, everybody. My name's Sean. I'm an alcoholic. I am certainly grateful to be here, grateful to be sober, and I appreciate Billy's hospitality. He's made sure that I got here on. We had a little bit of misdirection on the way here, but we figured it out before we went too far, so it was good. And but I that's right. I know it's reaching out for help. That's how novel is that? And but I am I'm going to try to tell my story in a general way, what I was like, what happened to me, and what I'm like now. And I do want to tell you that I've been sober since November 4th, 1995. I'm a member of the Midtown Group in Washington, D.C. Formerly Washington, D.C. Now we're meeting in Bethesda, Maryland. And we're a traveling meeting. And we've got this place for at least a year, so we're under a lease. And not too much fire. And I have a sponsor. And that's important to me because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 18, 19 years old, I went to a treatment center for 30 days, and I had the signs of heavy drinking, or I had problems with alcohol, I had problems with drugs, but I didn't surrender to this idea that I was an alcoholic, and I didn't really think that alcoholism was something that was that it had applied to me. And I mean, I was young, you know, it was a phase I was going through. I mean, it was the kind of idea. But I was so afraid of drinking that I hung in there for probably too long, to be honest, because I was wound up tight. I was crazy, afraid, full of fear, and I stayed sober for about 7 years. And a little over 7 years of physical sobriety, as physically sober as I am today. And I want to tell you that prior to getting to that point of a relapse, I do want to go back into some of my drinking so I can kind of give you an idea of just I've got some time. So I want to tell you that I grew up in Denver, Colorado, and I was raised in a somewhat, I don't know, I guess you would call it a broken home. My mom died when I was really young, 5, 6 years old. And my dad, he liked to drink, he liked to party, and I was basically raised by my grandparents for the most part. And I remember early on just running around a house and it was full of parties and naked women, and I just remember I was 5, 6 years old, and I gravitated to the back room, and they were playing strip poker, and they let me play a couple of rounds, and I don't know why to this day. Maybe it was cute or fun, and I don't know if I ever really remember drinking during that time period, but I do remember that, you know. And I kind of felt I didn't know it at the time, but when my mom died, something inside of me, when you lose a parent, I mean, something happens to you. And I've seen this, you know with other people now that I've been, you know, I've got more experience, but I just was full of fear, and I felt isolated, and I felt alone. And I mean, I didn't know that then. I'm looking back on it, that's what it was. I was growing up in a house that was not normal to most folks. And my dad didn't take me to the funeral, and he got remarried to a woman that was, you know, she made me tie my shoes, she made me clean my room. I hated her. She was just mean. And, you know, I had to start wiping my own butt. It wasn't fair. And because up to that point, I mean, my grandmother was basically taking care of me, you know. And up to the day, you know, she died, she just, you know, she loved me to death. You know, I was basically her favorite grandson because I was basically the only grandchild she really raised. And I could do no wrong in her eyes. And I took full advantage of that. And, you know, anytime anytime there was like any kind of problems, you know, I'd go crying to Grandma, and she would defend me. You know, it's not his fault. You know, it's not your fault, Sean. You know, you're just, you know, you're different from the rest of the kids. And with the rest of the grandkids, I was different. I mean, I had a different growing up and upbringing, and so I didn't really, I didn't think that that was going to be like the stamp to victimization, but I had it, you know, it wasn't my fault. And I, coming into Alcoholics Anonymous the first time, it wasn't my fault. It was your fault. You know, you were the reason that I had all these problems. You were the reason that I was drinking, you know, all this time, you know. My, I started drinking, I don't remember the first time I drank, but I do remember the first time I got drunk. We were having vodka, and what happened was my friends from next door, there was two girls that lived right next to me, and there was a guy that lived down the street, and the girl Regina, she was, I don't know, maybe 5-6 years older than me, and she was a little wild, and she's like, "Did your parents have any alcohol? Is there any alcohol in your house?" You know, and they were, you know, we were playing outside, and there were going to be like a little sleepover, and I said, "Well, yeah, I know. There's my dad had a whole stocked liquor bar downstairs, and I figured, well, there's four of us. I better get a lot of alcohol. You know, I better get the one with the most." And I picked Smirnoff vodka, and she took a swig of that, and I watched her, and I took notes, and she had, she's like, "Ah, that feels, you know, that was good, you know." And I can still remember it today. I took a swig of that, and I just, and my mouth started watering. My whole, from here up, just was like red, just totally warm. I was like, "Wow," you know, and I barely got that one down, you know. But after the third one, we started rocking. And what was interesting about that is that I was really afraid of girls, and I was really intimidated by this guy that came over, you know. And you know, we played a couple of drinking games with that bottle of vodka, and but I felt, for once, I felt like I was equal with them. Like they didn't. There was something about alcohol that changed the way I felt, and I didn't know it at the time, but that was something that turned into a career for me. And I was cursed or blessed, I don't know how you look at it. For me, I could drink a lot of alcohol and not get a hangover. A lot of alcohol. I could, and there was only three times from the time that I was, when I started drinking around 15, 16 years old till about 18, and I only got sick three times with a hangover, like a really bad hangover. And every time that happened, you know, you just drink a bottle of water and it goes away. So you feel a lot better. And then you feel drunk again. And so it wasn't like, it wasn't too bad. And, but I, what happened to me was, I got involved with, my parents moved from Colorado to Kentucky, and I hated it. And I got really mad at my dad. And I got separated from all of my friends from, you know, senior year of high school. I mean, what was he thinking? Doesn't he know that, like, this is my lifeline? And, but I, you know, I kind of blended right in. I got in with a couple of guys as soon as I got there, and we started drinking and doing drugs. But I still wanted to go back to Colorado. I was so mad at my dad, and I really hated him for a long time. And I didn't really even know that until I got sober, that I really didn't like how he raised me. And I hated God, and I hated, you know, the fact that my mom died, you know, and I felt this overwhelming sense of victimization. And I carried that through my first years of sobriety. And I didn't really ever deal with that when I was sober the first time. And I never took a four-step or fifth step my first year, my first time I was in sobriety for my first sobriety date. And so that left undealt with, and then what I like to call is untreated alcoholism, and that happens when I'm not drinking, that the restlessness, the irritability, the discontentment with my life, the things that are going on with work, I get angry, I get frustrated at people at work, and I scream at them. I did well for once I got sober. I was working as a pizza delivery driver. And that was what I was doing when I got sober the first time. And I got promoted. When I got sober, I finally got promoted to a store manager. And they moved me to Evansville, Indiana. And by this time, I had already married my first wife. And she was a nice gal. I mean, she was just really nice from, you know, Glendale, Kentucky. And she just, you know, she was very, very loving and very kind. And I was a rotten SOB. And I destroyed that marriage in sobriety. And I cheated on her. That remorse and that guilt. Because I didn't, see, what I didn't realize is that I don't have the power to change the way I am. I didn't want to. Morally, I thought, this isn't going to happen. You know, and I even said it. You know, I had a conversation with a girl before it happened. Didn't talk to her for like 2 weeks about it. I mean, she worked for me. And so did her husband. It was a little complicated. And but for like two weeks, we didn't say anything or whatever. And then, you know, things weren't going well at home. And so one thing, I have to fix how I feel about me inside with something on the outside. And that's what happened. And I ended up, you know, destroying that marriage. And that was like pretty much one of the straws that broke the camel's back to the uncomfortability, that restlessness, the irritability, the discontentment that I was talking about in sobriety. Sober, I'm doing that kind of behavior, and so drinking starts to become, you know, a good idea. And that's what led me to that point. And I had started, and I come back to this idea of the surrender. I was surrendering to this idea that I was an alcoholic was not something that I gave into. What happened was that my grandmother, I guess I had about 3 years of sobriety, I went out to go see her and my grandpa and a bunch of people during the holidays, and one of the holidays, and I ended up going to NA, and I was like, I'm going to go to a meeting, and my dad had to bring me, and I think they have a bunch of readings too, and my dad ended up reading one of the readings, and I asked my dad after the meeting was over, I was like, what'd you think of it? He's like, well, it's a little bit closer to home than I would really want, you know, to think about right now, you know. And I was like, my dad, he's got a problem too, and I don't know why that made me uncomfortable, but I was already feeling all these uncomfortable feelings. And my grandfather, he made jugs of wine, and there was four big jugs of wine in the fridge, and I went into a compulsion, and I prayed and I prayed and I prayed, but I made it through that. But the next night I went to a meeting. And my grandmother, she was like, at this point, she was like, she's like, you're going to go to another meeting tonight, you know? And I was like, yeah. She's like, do you have to go to all those meetings? Yeah. But what happened was I wasn't sure. I wasn't really sure if I had to go to all those meetings or not. No, and I didn't have a sponsor other than in name, so why would I have to go to all those meetings? So I didn't have any anybody checking my ideas. And that's what happened. And that was at three. I had about 3 years of sobriety, and for 4 years, I slowly, over a period of time, stopped going to meetings or went to a lot less meetings. And then I would only go to meetings on my days off. So I was going down to two meetings a week, three meetings a week. And then these were meetings that, like, I could watch people. They were laughing. They were happy. They seemed much happier than me. And I was like, I don't know what's wrong with me. And I just stopped relating to the people in the meetings. And I ended up, what ended up happening? I ended up, the relationship that I had cheated on, it got a little rough. And she ended up getting divorced. The girl that I cheated on, she ended up getting divorced with her husband, and they had a child. And my wife found out about it. And instead of going to counseling, we just moved towns. And I changed jobs. I was still working in the pizza business, but I was working for a competitor across the river in Owensboro, Kentucky. And things went okay for a while, but I wanted to get out of that. I was high school education, and I have no means of making, you know, any kind of livelihood. And I also had a kid, and my wife really had a problem with that. She's like, she just had this idea that, you know, she should be the one to bear my first child, and she didn't like that idea that I had a kid, and I gave that child up for adoption. Because she wasn't gonna, I did it not of my own fruition, but of what my wife wanted. And I felt terrible about that decision. And I didn't, again, I'm doing all these things sober and not checking any of these ideas by with anybody. And so my life is, again, progressively getting worse and worse and worse. And I eventually ended up, I had this idea since my wife had, her dad was a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army, and he flew planes. I'd just join the Army. That'd be a great idea. You know, he would finally like me now. and I could get a good trade, and I could make more money, and then we could start this family, you know. And what happened was I joined the Army, and when I joined the Army, my meetings went from 2 to 0. And I was still praying, and I would go to the chaplain and, you know, ask him to, you know, can you help me? You know, things are a little rough at home. But I started hanging out with people in bars. They were drinking. I was watching them drink. And I was watching the effects they got from drinking. And it looked good. And then I would get afraid because I'd think that way, but I wouldn't tell anybody. And then I'd just, you know, more uncomfortable, unmanageable, self-will actions, creating damage with people in my life, you know, not really showing up for my family. My dad, my stepmom, they were going through some problems themselves. They ended up splitting up. They had already started the process of splitting up, and I just not showing up for my sister, I was a train wreck in sobriety, and I was living a life of a drunk, but I wasn't drinking, and that can be really uncomfortable, and I tell you, it was extremely uncomfortable, when I came back, I went through basic training. I went through my AIT. And then when I graduated the training, they sent me to South Korea. South Korea. I got orders to go to South Korea. And by this time, my wife, she decided she was done with me. And she said, you know, I don't I don't love you anymore, and I just, you know, I don't want to be with you anymore, and we need to get a divorce. And so 16 days I was on leave, we got a divorce. It was uncontested. I gave her everything she wanted, and we broke it off, and I was pretty much, I had most of my eggs in that basket. I mean, I had a few in my family, but most of my eggs were in that basket. And when that ended, when that relationship ended, and I didn't have any foundation in sobriety or a higher power, I ended up, you know, getting really, really depressed, self-pity, and I was consumed with it. And I think it was really, it was so bleak. I remember it. It's just so bleak how the thing that I couldn't figure out is how I got there. It baffled me. How did I get myself into that? You know, I wanted to blame my wife. I did. The way I felt. You know, I wanted to blame my wife for the problems we had. You know, it was her fault. You know, I wanted to blame my parents because of the way they raised me. I wanted to blame God again, you know, because, you know, if I would have had a mom, this stuff wouldn't happen, you know. And I was caught in extreme self-centeredness. And I ended up drinking when I got stationed over in Korea, and about 3 weeks later. And I drank the entire time I was on tour over there. And I can tell you from my own experience of the fatal illness, alcoholism, is that it is progressive. If you're an alcoholic of my type, and you go back to drinking, it gets progressively worse. And I didn't drink for 7.5 years, and I think I picked up right where I left off, and it took less than 30 days. I was emotionally pretty much distraught, and I was drinking basically for oblivion. I wanted my life to be over, and I wanted to have fun, you know. I wanted to, you know, live the wild life that I had when I was 18 years old, you know, going to bars and stuff. But it wasn't happening anymore, and I just many times I would have these outbreaks of ain't nothing like just hanging out with a drinker that just cries in his beer, because that's all I did. And I tell you, it didn't help. There was one radio station that was English, and one Air American Forces Korean Network, and there was one TV station and that was English. And And so we watched that, and one night I remember, I don't even remember what the name of the movie was, but it was definitely, there was a woman that, you know, was hiding vodka bottles all over the place. She ended up having to go to AA. And it just brought, if AA did nothing else, it ruined all of my drinking from then point out. It's what it did. And so I saw this movie, and I got really, really depressed. I was drinking still, and I couldn't not think about it. I just, no matter how much I poured in me, and I got so bad that I actually called my drinking buddy, and he lived off post with his wife, and he heard me for about 25 minutes, you know, and I told him everything about the affair, about how I was an alcoholic, about how I stopped drinking again, and blah, 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 blah. I ran it for 25 minutes. And he's like, "It's okay, dude. It's okay. It's okay. I'll be over in a little bit," you know. And he brought over a case of beer, and we ended up drinking, you know, some more. And so that wasn't really the answer, you know. That wasn't really the answer. And so even though I knew what my problem was, I could not, of my own fruition, I couldn't stop drinking on my own. And I was caught in what the book talks about is the hideous four horsemen: terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. And when I was sober during that time period, I had it, and it was on me all the time. And I just couldn't wait till I drank again. And the whole time I was over in South Korea, that's all I did. just waiting for the next day off so I could drink again. And I was I was promoted to chronic. And I came back to the States, and within a month I got busted for a DUI down at Fort Belvoir. And it was a Tuesday night. I blew a .13. 2.5 hours later or whatever, they had to wake up the lady that ran the machine, and she took forever. And I didn't have to go in the jail. I was in the military, and that looks really bad. I had a security clearance, and I was looking to lose it all. I was basically looking to lose it all. And if I really, the grace of God entered my life. But what happened was on the 2nd of November, I got the DUI. I got released on the 3rd, and around 5 o'clock in the evening, I woke up or came to, and I went straight to the fridge. There was 3 beers there, and I started drinking again. And I didn't want to drink. I was drinking against my will. And it wasn't for a while in AA that I looked back on that part of my life where I was powerless over alcohol. Whether I knew it or not, I was powerless over alcohol. And my life was certainly unmanageable because I had made my life a mess. And I was basically just waiting for the end, you know. And so that particular moment when I drank the next night, I went out and went to the bar. I left my friend there that I went with, and I came back and I felt utterly disgusted with myself, and I was in a lot of trouble. I knew I was in a lot of trouble, and I talked to my senior NCO, and he gave me the number to a lawyer. I called the lawyer up. It was $1,000. You know, I went to go see the guy. He told me what the deal was. You know, this is what you're going to probably face. And what happened was, for me, I don't know. I didn't want to come back to AA. I certainly didn't want to, you know, hang out with a bunch of alcoholics because I had been to AA and AA didn't work. That was my mindset. It couldn't work for me because I had been here for 7 years and I ended up drinking again. How is this going to work for somebody like me? And as fate would have it, there was a guy at my work on my shift, the worst guy. I hated him. He was a jerk. I couldn't believe it. He was just very corny. I don't know. I did not like him. and he just happened to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he happened to be a member of my home group that I have today. And he didn't know anything about me. He didn't know anything about my circumstances. But he knew everything about my business because I was a public record. Everybody knew that I'd gotten in trouble. And so he gave me a big book. I got my security clearance got suspended. And so I wasn't working except 9 to 5, Monday through Friday. And which was a blessing. I didn't see it as a blessing at the time, but it was most definitely a blessing. Because it freed up a lot of my time to go to meetings. And I just can't even tell you how much God was working in my life, even though I had lost, you know, left him long ago. But he gave me a book, and he took me to my first meeting. He took me to, like, the Unity Club. And I got a chip, and then, like, a couple days later was Sunday night, and I ended up going to my home group, And I was just absolutely terrified to be in AA, and I was shaking to go pick up my chip, and there were so many people. And if you ever get a chance to come up, you know, you're more than welcome. We'd love to have you. And I know Billy's come up and spoken, and there's a lot of common people we have amongst both of our groups. But the interesting fact about that was is that I didn't come back to AA to stop drinking. I had no motive to come back to AA. The only reason that I'm talking to you tonight is because that guy got me out of work an hour and a half early. That's it. That's the only reason I started going to AA. Had he not got me out of work, I probably would have come. You know, and I was working 12-hour shifts at the time. And so it doesn't really matter how you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. My hope is that, you know, if you do come to AA and if you're new, that you stick around here long enough until you hear your story and that you can identify with somebody else in the meeting. Because that's what had to happen for me, is that I was in a place of quiet desperation. I was living a lonely, lonely life. And I came to that meeting, and people came up to me after that meeting. They shook my hand. They overwhelmed me is what they did. There's about five or six guys that came up to me right after that meeting, and they surrounded me. They wouldn't let me go, and they wanted to know what I was doing the next day. Nobody up to that point really cared what I was doing. And now I got five guys want to know what I'm doing. That was very attractive to me. I was intimidated by it, and I was very afraid. And I ended up exchanging a couple of numbers with a couple of people there. And I kind of blew them off for about a week and a half or something like that. And I got six beers in the back of my truck, just waiting for another day off. And it was like November, I don't know, middle of November in 95, and it was raining really bad. I lived at Fort Belvoir, and some guy had called me, or there was a dance. I don't know, for whatever reason, I thought a dance was going to be okay to go to. I don't know, whatever. I called this guy, and I go the wrong way around the Beltway. And it takes me like 2 hours to get to his house. It's pouring down rain. And I got the beer in the back of my truck. I get to his house. At meeting time. He waited. Like, he's not going to make it to the meeting. He stayed for whatever reason. He stayed and he waited for me. And we got in the truck. And we started driving the other way. And it started snowing. And I needed gas. And I stopped at the gas station. And I was filling up my tank. And I'm looking at my toolbox. I had a pickup truck. And I knew there was 6 Killian Reds in there. And I got an AA guy in my truck. I got 6 Killian Reds in there. There's an AA guy in my truck. There's a beer in my car. And I debated this for the whole time I was gassing up. And I got in my car, and I looked at the guy, and I don't know where this came from, but I said, I got beer in the back of my truck. Can you throw it away? I didn't want to do that. It's Killian's Red. I mean, come on. I mean, that's what I thought. You know, I was like, that's one of my best tasting beers. You know, and Michelob Dark, those are my, you know, ace in the holes, you know. But I, for whatever reason, I did that, and then we went there. We caught the last 5 minutes of Brother Alexis's talk in Annapolis. He was speaking that night. I didn't hear a word he said, but I was at the dance, and everybody was, you know, clearing out and then setting up for the dance. You know how sometimes you go to meeting, there's a dance like right after, and people are clearing out, and this guy that I brought, you know, is talking to me, and then, you know, a couple other people come start talking to me, and without knowing it, I mean, I just, looking back at it now, I was just really tricked. I didn't because what happened was is this guy started talking to me, and he asked me, I was watching this girl dance, this like know, 10, 12-year-old girl dance. And I tried to get out on the floor with my cowboy boots on, and it wasn't happening. There was nothing happening. All I could think about is, you know, my whole life and how it had gone to crap. And I'm never going to have a good life again, you know. You know, just normal, you know, newcomer thinking. And, you know, in my depression, this guy asked me how I'm doing. And I don't know if somebody that talked as long as I did that night would listen to me. But this guy listened to me for like 3 hours at that dance. He was having some if you hear his side of it, he was having some difficulties with his girlfriend that night, so he was glad to talk to me. And I'm glad he did, because that was and he didn't stop me once. He listened to me the whole time, complain, cry, bitch, moan, the whole time. And at the end of it, at the end of the dance, he said, "What are you doing tomorrow?" And I said, "I have no idea." And he said, "Well, why don't you come pick me up and we'll go to a meeting?" And we did. And he's very active, my sponsor, very active. And he didn't listen to me after that. I just want to make that note of that. Is he didn't listen to me at all after that, I thought. He didn't. He heard all he needed to hear. I needed action. I needed action badly. And he made sure that I got it. Because I would go and I would pick him up for the meeting, and we would go make coffee, which was his service position, and he was just showing me what to do constantly. And when I was new, I would go everywhere to do all these different things in AA, and I didn't know it at the time, but that was the thing that I come back to, like, it doesn't matter how you feel about your circumstances. It doesn't matter we don't care if you believe in a higher power or not. What we matter is what you do. Because I didn't believe in God. I couldn't believe in a higher power, but I could believe in these drunks because they were staying sober, and I would come to the meetings and I would sit through the meeting barely, and I would feel safe after I left the meeting. Sometimes I wouldn't. Sometimes I'd be thinking about drinking. I thought about drinking a lot, but rarely did I feel like drinking in the meeting. And slowly over a period of time, all these actions that I took, I was able to find some sort of relief from the problems that I was having or experiencing. Not that those problems went away, because they didn't. I was still on probation. I still had all these problems. You know, I had to pay the $1,000, you know, for the lawyer, but I had a different outcome in that. And my sponsor, he got me into action of taking a four step after about. I knew that that was one of my weaknesses. I had not done the steps, and I took a four step, and I shared my fifth step with my sponsor, and what happened was. For me, and I know it doesn't happen like this for everybody, but when I wrote down everything in my four step, everything that I had ever done, that I swore I was never going to tell anybody, and I was going to take it to the grave, because you don't talk to anybody about this kind of stuff, about how dirty, rotten. I was actually suicidal the whole time I was writing my four step. I felt disgusting. I felt disgusted with who and what I had become, and I didn't know how I could get there, and I didn't know how I could get out of it. And then I shared that with my sponsor, and I did exactly what it says in the book. You know, we take the book down from the shelf, we read the first five proposals, and then we sit quietly for an hour and reflect on those things, you know. And then we ask God to help us to be rid of all these things, you know, or at least help us through all of these things so we can become a better person, you know. And I felt, not that night, but the next couple of days, something had happened to me that I can't really put a finger on, other than the actions that I was doing in AA, and my start starting to believe in a power greater than myself that I couldn't see and I couldn't trust. And I felt free for the first time in my life ever. All of that stuff that I had done, all of those things that I had become, everything that I thought about me, it wasn't okay that I did them, but it was I was okay with who I was. There was a guy that knew everything about me, and he took my call the next day. And it's good to feel like, you know, you're not the only leper in the leper colony, you know. And that's what had happened to me. Now, from there, I got about 12 minutes, but what happened from there is I didn't do anything for a while. And I just kind of rode the fellowship. It's very easy to ride the fellowship in our meeting. And unfortunately, that is the case. And a lot of people just, you know, they get there, they have fun, they see people having a good time. And that's what I did. I had a good time. You know, a lot of people hanging out, lots of activities. We would go to conferences. And, you know, Poe, this, you know, a couple weeks from now, I went to that several times in a row. And, you know, just doing all these kind of things and having a great time. And life is grand. And slowly, it's, you know, the little thing in my chest, it's winding up and it's feeling uncomfortable again. I'm starting to, you know, I get married, you know, buy a house, you know, it's a little house. It's not the best house, you know, but it's my house. And, you know, I have a couple people I'm sponsoring, you know, and, you know, things okay, things are going good, and just coasting right along, doing good, you know. How you doing? Good, good. Work's going good, things are going well. And there were a couple other things that happened prior to that that I did concerning my eighth and ninth step without really knowing that's what I was doing. But that my ex-wife, my sponsor suggested that I write a letter to her. And after about six drafts, we got one that worked. And he had me, you know, send it to her parents, because that was the only address that I knew. And I didn't know what that was quite about. And then I got a response, I don't know, maybe 3-4 months later, and it's 9, 10, 15 page letter. So long, I still have the letter, you know, and she's doing just fine without me, is basically what it said. And she has a husband and a couple kids now, and she's happy. Thank you very little, you know. And but I felt free. I felt free, and I've done everything that I could do to right that wrong, you know. And that doesn't make what I did right, because I was a scum. I was a jerk, and I deserved what I got. And but I started to not be a victim. I was starting to realize that, oh, when it talks about this, you know, we're like the actor who wants to run the whole show, and they paint this, you know, grand scheme, and how, you know, I can be nice and kind and considerate, but I can also be a little mean, egotistical, you know. I like to retaliate, you know. You know, every once in a while I like to fight with people because I want to be right, because I am right, you know. And so I have this, and so... But those type of things cause difficulties, you know, and uncomfortability. And if I don't, you know, if I don't take stock of, you know, my case, then it's just, it causes problems. And so I did a lot of upfront, really important ninth step work with my sponsor without ever doing an eighth and ninth step. But then it wasn't until you know, my 10th year of sobriety, where just, I mean, things with my wife were not going well. We have two kids, some uncomfortability. You know, I'm feeling it, and you know, it's just I can't be loving and kind in, at the house, and you know, she's fighting with me, and we're fighting about you know, she's European, I'm American. We have two kids. She sees things differently than I do, and so we don't get along with a lot of things. And you know what? I don't have the best communication skills. And we don't talk about it, but we're in it. We're doing it. But we can't talk about it, and so it's kind of like things that are left untouched, you know. And we just assume that, you know, we'll just take it one day at a time. And there's just no way to... I mean, you can live one day at a time, but you have to talk about things. You have to plan things. You have to try to... You know, shoot for things. You know, how are you going to raise the kids? How are you, you know, what kind of schools are you going to put them in? What kind of beliefs do you have? I mean, that's important stuff, because if it's different, there's going to be problems in the house. And there were so much where I couldn't change. She was unwilling to change. It was animosity, and we ended up, you know, separating. And it's been 3 years now, and it just... No, if nothing else I've learned in AA, I'm really not good in personal relationships. I'm not good with the opposite sex. They just, it's my communication. But I know that I wasn't, you know, it's not all her. It's me. There was something that I did. There were things that I did in that relationship. And I didn't, you know, I wasn't as spiteful as I was in the first one. I didn't have to cheat on her, you know, patient progress, work getting better. but the main, through all of that, I've been able to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't skimped on one AA commitment that somebody's thrown my way. I still take people's phone calls when somebody needs help. I'm going to pick up the phone. You need to go to a meeting? We'll go to a meeting. If I have an H&I commitment, I go to that commitment. I show up there. And if I can't make it, then I call. And those are the type of principles that no matter what's going on the outside, I have something that's worthwhile here, that's an investment here, because in reality I would not be sober, and I wouldn't have a chance at a new way of life if I didn't make this a way of life. I had a way of life that was pretty much reckless abandon. And today I have a life that, as difficulties arise with my personal relationships, I have a sponsor I can talk to. He can give me a better way to do something. You know, I've gotten out of a lot of scrapes by just listening to him and doing what he suggested. Sometimes I've had to ride it out, you know, and do it my way. And that's been painful. But he's, you know, people let you do that, you know. But when I've invested my, you know, all my eggs in the AA basket, no matter what's going on in my life on the outside, helping a newcomer, trying to talk to somebody, trying to help them, and not necessarily even by sponsoring them. I was in a thing for a while where I just, you know, sponsor. And I got caught up in my ego in that. And I tell you what, some of the people that helped me the most are the people that I helped that you know, just needed a ride home, you know, or, you know, they wanted to talk to somebody and I was able to be their friend. And, you know, helping somebody get new and not get wrapped around. Because I can easily get caught in my ego, even in here, you know, with doing the good thing, you know. And so what I want to share about also in that relationship with the amends that I made to my grandmother. She passed away just a couple of years ago. In my 10th year of sobriety, I finally made a ninth, you know, an 8-step list. And there, you know, there's about 4 pages of people on there. And most of them I've addressed at some level. Some of them I can't do anything about. There's nothing I can do. My mom, she's dead. My grandmother, she passed away, but I was able to be there for her. You know, the last couple of months of her life, you know, calling her all the time. You know, she was big into pictures and, you know, sending her pictures of her grandkids or great-grandkids. And to help my grandfather when he went through, you know, losing his wife. And the other thing was is that I made amends to my mom because there was I had a deep hate, you know, like for leaving me. But I went out to her grave. It was suggested I write a letter. Somebody suggested that I write a letter, and I wrote her, you know, just basically catching her up with my entire life. And I went out to her gravesite, and I went with, you know, her sister. And she, because I didn't know where the site is, it's not marked. And I sat there for a long while and just, you know, I didn't read the letter because I didn't want them to wait, you know, an hour. I didn't want them to be there an hour. It wouldn't be right, you know, to have them wait and I read this entire letter to her, you know, while they waited. I was there for about 10 minutes and I left her my chip and I got to hang out with, you know, her family, basically. And the other thing, that's healed. That's healed. I don't have any regret for that. I wouldn't be telling you about it if I didn't deal with it at some level. And hopefully, you know, somebody has the same experience. And the last thing, I've got just a few, 30 seconds, according to this watch here, is that my father, at 10 years, that relationship healed through him coming to my 10-year anniversary. And he got to see how I live. He got to know that by coming to the meetings and seeing my friends and seeing my sponsor and the people that I sponsor, he got to see that his son is safe. And that's my time. I want to thank the group for allowing me to come down here and speak. And if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have the life I have today. And I have a great life. I have an absolutely great life because of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.